From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. We may think of my guest today as the star of 24 or Designated Survivor. I think of him as being the star and director of To the Consequences, New Mexico.
Oh, wow.
One of my favorite films.
Thank you so much.
Kiefer Sutherland sitting here. First of all, it's so great to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
But it's interesting because going back to that film, but also so many things you've done. I mean, think about that terrific turn you did in something that people didn't get a chance to see, the pilot for the TV version of L.A. Confidential.
Right, yeah.
Where, and this seems like this last 20 years or so of your career, you've been dealing with characters who, one way or another, have to deal with authority.
Right.
And ask themselves where they belong in that.
Right.
And you've chosen projects that ask questions about the nature of authority. And I think it goes back to Truth or Consequences.
Mm-hmm. I think that's something that we wrestle as individuals and as a society at large. I think one of the most unique things, my father being Canadian, I'm a Canadian as well, constantly got asked what we thought the difference was, if any, between Americans and Canadians. And my dad had a really wonderful answer. And he said, when we grew up, we were taught to kind of, we admired the Mountie, and because the Mountie always got his man. And there was safety in the idea that there was structure and that that structure would be followed and that there was law and order. And as Americans, I couldn't help but notice that you all fell in love with the criminals and you fell in love with, you know, William H. Bonney, Billy the Kid and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and all the bank robbers and train robbers. And that made sense because Canada never had a Revolutionary War. Canada was part of the British Dominion right up and through the late 60s. The United States was formed by a group of people that were tough enough and strong enough to say, no, we're not going to take this anymore. And in 1776, took arms up against the greatest empire in the world. And they won. And so I'll never forget, there was an interesting thing in World War I when the American soldiers arrived late. There was a lot of criticism that they did not have the training, nor did they have the weapons to sufficiently fight alongside the French and the British in World War I. And then very quickly, they took note that they were really good street fighters and maybe they didn't need weapons at all. And I always thought that was really impressive. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. I want to live in a society that obeys the law and that there are some parameters that we will all live within. But there's something great to admire about the independence of the American idea of liberty and freedom. And so it's a fascinating thing.
Well, that whole sort of epithet you just offered us is really kind of a summation of what the Caine Mutiny court-martial is about, those questions.
Yeah.
And going back to read the book, which I hadn't read, but I'd certainly seen the movie and had seen the play before, I was struck by the amount of ambiguity that Billy Friedkin brought to it, that it really is a sort of about saying that everybody's to blame. And at some point, you stand up for something.
Well, and I got that too. As an actor, you will always read the script and you will have an overview of all of the characters and you will lay judgment to all of those characters and how they interact together, ultimately to tell the story that you're trying to tell. But your first responsibility is to your character and what you're going to do with that and how those choices are going to impact the other characters and ultimately tell the story. And for me, the more and more I looked into the script, and the script really doesn't deviate that far from the film that was made by Humphrey Bogart, except to the extent that we don't ever leave the courtroom. There are no flashback scenes to the boat. There is no flashback scene to any other conversations other than what is described in the courtroom sequences. And I realized during that dialogue, because it had been so refined, that the character really kind of laid before me in two parts. And the things that this character was confronting were two things that both broke my heart. There's a terrible moment when you get older in life when you actually are confronted with the idea of the man you wanted to be and the reality of the man you are. And that's a terrible moment for everybody. That's a terrible moment because youth gives you so much hope and time, and that if you make a mistake here, you can fix it there. There's some time down the road, and at a certain point in life, you realize...
You have the arrogance that you'll be able to fix it as a young
and then
person.
At some point in life, you realize that this is really just what it is. And so we all have that confrontation, and to different degrees. And this character is having a massive confrontation with the fact that he thought and wanted to be this man, but in reality was not, and did not have the courage and did not have the strength and did not have the foresight to be the man he wanted to be, but in fact he was something very different. And of course, the second part of the character, which is completely reinforced by the first part, is this terrible moment when you start to become irrelevant. There was a time in World War II where they needed this man. And despite some of his shortcomings, they were going to put up with it because he was willing to risk his life and he was willing to go into battle and he was needed and he was required. And now at this age and not in war, or not at war any longer, he is less relevant. And you watch him come to terms with that it's all over, that his sense of importance and belonging in a larger society, and that being the Navy, is over. And those are two heartbreaking moments. And we watch a very human kind of reaction to that.
So many of the characters you played have this kind of bifurcated nature, where they're asking themselves something about who they are versus what the way other people see them. I mean, we could say that's certainly who Jack Bauer is, but I think that's also...
Well, getting older helps.
But also him asking himself that question of, how do other people see me? And I would say the same thing about Designated Survivor, mm-hmm. too. And again, I'll go back to Truth or Consequences. Yeah. These people who think they're seen one way, and as they step out into this world, they realize that people see them in other ways. Mm-hmm. This has been so often something that you've been... attracted to as an actor,
I think. It's something that I'm fascinated by as a human being, and it's something that I'm constantly questioning in myself all the time, and as well others. Jack Bauer was an interesting character because I discovered him as I went. As you referred to earlier, I had done one other pilot before, so my experience was kind of very minimal, but things work at a much quicker pace than I was certainly used to in the film industry, and I ended up coming to love that so much. I remember I went and did a film while we were making 24 with Michael Douglas. I walked up to him, and he's a wonderful friend of mine, and he produced Flatliners. We've known each other for a very long time. And he said, "Hey, you all right?" And I said, "I don't know how you do this." And he said, "What?" I said, "Make films." He said, "Well, you make films." I said, "No, I used to make films. I don't know how you do this. This is like watching paint dry. And I don't see it being any better." And he went, "Well, there's a concern." And so the energy that you got off of doing something like 24 was just kind of exhilarating. And I learned to kind of love that. But the character was really interesting. And so as I'm discovering the character, we're kind of releasing episodes, right? It's all happening at once. And so how I ended up defining the character was really interesting. For the very first time in my life, I was defining what I thought the character was while an audience was watching it, right? And they were making judgments on it too. And fortunately for me, they were liking it and they were enjoying it.
It's funny as you say, because I saw the pilot for 24 before 9/11.
Yeah.
So seeing the show drop after 9/11 was a very different experience.
It was completely different. And I realized that I felt that the reason people were responding to the show as strongly as they were was because this person was put in front of circumstances he couldn't possibly win, but he's still going to try. And you know he's going to lose. It's just about how much. And I think people feel like that every day. And it doesn't matter whether they're going to work for, you know, as a mail person or a garbage truck delivery person or as a carpenter. I think most people feel that it's all stacked against them. And it's just a question of, like, how well can I lose? Right? And I felt that way about Jack Bauer in a really strong way. And I followed through with that to the very, very, like, that literally was the parameter for me of what I thought was going to be a good episode or a good season or ultimately a good series of 24, was how convincingly can we put him in a position where you're making that terrible decision that you're not going to save 100 people. But you're going to actually have to make the terrible decision of what 80 do you pick? And more importantly, what 20 do you not pick? Those are choices that shouldn't be made by human beings. and yet they are.
It's the truth. We're getting very philosophical with my guest, Kiefer Sutherland. He's currently featured in the last film, William Friedkin, the Court Martial, which is on Showtime. You also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But I do think there's, as you were talking about that kind of split, and I was thinking as you were talking about 24, about what it was like to see the show, because I felt one way about seeing the pilot, which is, why are we trusting this person with this much power?
Mm-hmm.
And then when the show drops, like, I wonder what it's like for others who weren't exposed to it before the world changed.
Yeah.
And again, for me, that's about a guy operating versus the way he's perceived. And I thought that very much in watching your Queeg here, just because unlike, say, Humphrey Bogart, he smiles. I think he wants to be liked.
Very much so.
And I thought it was really interesting for you to play it that way, because the hand, we see the hand going before he even speaks in that chair.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, he's trying to work this out physically before he speaks.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really impressed with the deliberation and the physical deliberation.
Oh,
in that.
Thank you. Thank you. He clearly wanted to be liked, and who doesn't?
And in fact, no, that's a really risky way to play someone like that, because usually you think of him as being kind of Martinet, who's going here with orders. But this is somebody, you gave him a real
but
soul.
If you don't start there, you have very little room to move, right? And I think that at the beginning, he absolutely does think he's liked. And I think he thinks the officers will side with him and that his story is going to ring true and they're going to condemn these mutineers. And they will pay a price. And I think if you don't start there, then you have really nowhere to go. If you start kind of aggressive, you're kind of always mapping out how much room you're going to have to move to get to your ultimate kind of end. And by the way, I mean, all of these conversations were had with Mr. Friedkin, and he complained with me up until his passing, asking me to call him Billy. I just couldn't do it. I went from sir to Mr. Friedkin, because this is one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And I've heard so many people say one of the great American filmmakers. Yes, absolutely. But one of the great filmmakers of all time. If you just simply take The French Connection and The Exorcist and just realize that he completely redefined both genres, right? Genre of horror film and the genre of the thriller, period. I mean, that kind of contribution is kind of almost unfathomable that that's accomplished by one person.
In less than 5 years.
Yeah, and an incredibly smart man. Tough guy. That's the one thing that if you're at a read-through or at a rehearsal or whatever, if he doesn't even notice you, then you're probably still all right. But if he says something nice about you, it's like, oh, good, you know, you can relax for a bit. I think he is such an insightful storyteller that I think, certainly in my experience on the Caine Mutiny, no single one actor wanted to be disappointing for him and to him. I mean, we shot that in an incredibly short time.
How short?
10 days.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, 2 weeks, 2 5-day weeks.
So you shot as if it were a play.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was. Yeah,
well,
sure.
And yeah, so the whole second testimony of mine was done in one take.
That whole monologue.
The whole thing, from the moment I walked through the doors to sitting down to walking back out the doors at the very end, that was all one take.
It's funny you say it, because I'm aware of the way he walks into the room, as if he's almost calculating the way he wants people to perceive him before he sits down.
Yeah. And the fascinating thing about that is people will go see the movie and they'll see all kinds of cuts. He had 7 cameras set up on that sequence. To be able to orchestrate 7 cameras, all of which have movement except for 2, following me almost 50 meters from the door of the courtroom into the chair and then back out, and not have those cameras run into each other, is one of the most incredible games of Tetris you will ever see. And he did it like it was nothing. I have a twin sister in Canada who is one of the most successful post-production supervisors. And we have a terrible habit in the production side of things of saying that we'll fix it in post. And my sister has a t-shirt that says, F you, fix it in prep. And he did, man. I mean, there's no way you can accomplish the lavish production of that film in 10 days if you don't know what you're doing. And it was on display. It was, and he wasn't like a peacock. The work stood for it. He wasn't saying how great he was. he was showing us. And it was so impressive. You know, Jason Clark was my dance partner in that. It was that whole show for me. It was basically he and I, he is a defending attorney coming at me as a witness. That was my dance partner. And he was extraordinary. And I think for us to be able to have those kinds of opportunities in text and material, to be able to work with someone like Mr. Friedkin was just awesome.
Well, my guest is awesome. He's Kiefer Sutherland. We can see him in the Caine Mutiny Court Martial, among many other things he's done in his career. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. My guest, who's never wrong, is Kiefer Sutherland. It's The Treatment, which you can also read at kcrw.com/thetreatment. We're talking about any number of things. So, of course, the Caine Mutiny Court Martial, which he's directed by William Friedkin, who was here and came with his book. And it was fun to talk to him because the thing I said to him, and I feel like this piece is about that too, is his pieces are so often about the war between chaos and order.
Mm-hmm.
And this is definitely one of those pieces too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The number of times, I would think it'll be absolutely uncountable, but in our society where we've done maybe not the right thing to do the larger right thing, and we've let people fall on swords that didn't deserve to fall on swords. I'm not saying that that's in the case of this film, but it certainly has a larger concept. We tend to look back in history and go, oh, we could have done better with that, or we should have done better with this, or this person maybe didn't commit that crime, but we let them kind of be sentenced for it because it was otherwise it was going to force us to look at an even uglier truth. Justice is and I mean that as a large idea, not just simply justice as we know it in a court of law, but justice and fairness. They're very hard things to obtain, and there's so many things at stake with this, and specifically fairness. I have two daughters and two stepsons, and watching young children kind of realize that it's not fair all the time is one of the most heartbreaking things you'll ever see, because they think it is, and they think it should be. And it's always so amazing to see children who really have a profound problem with something that's not being fair. And I can use myself as an example. I mean, I was not the easiest kid growing up. I was not a great student, and I was very flexible with the truth. But if I ever did tell the truth and someone finally called me a liar, I would lose my mind.
The more we talk about this, the more I can see where your divining rod is in this, in these characters. It's as if you push aside what's the dialogue to try to figure out intent in terms of who these characters want to be heard by.
Mm-hmm.
They use the word heartbreaking. And I never thought I would never append the word heartbreaking to Queek before this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he wants to be heard by everybody, but in a different key.
Yeah.
It's like he's doing an aria and he's changing the key for every single person in the gallery.
He wants to be loved. And he realizes very quickly he's not, then he loses his temper and then he tries to take it back.
But he also wants to be loved and admired simultaneously. Like
it's
that person, that kid you're talking about, but also this person who's come through 20 years in the military, who understands that you have to have your crew's admiration or else you can't walk across the deck of the ship.
He does or he doesn't. I mean, there's a large part of me that thinks that I outrank you and you have to love me, you know, and if you're not, you're insubordinate, you know.
There's certainly that, but that comes with the rule book.
Yeah.
He wants to be loved and admired.
Yeah.
Again, I just think back to seeing Bogart do it. It was just about, if I follow the rules, everybody should follow the rules.
Yes.
And I want to ask you about rehearsal time, because in that scene, there's so many different colorations to that. If you get rehearsal time to sort of figure out how many different pitches you wanted to hit.
We didn't really have rehearsal time, and it was mainly because we had a read-through where we didn't read through the script. It was really the most cool thing I've ever seen. So we all go up to his house, and we're sitting at a nice, I would think, dining room table. And he's sitting there, and he's looking at the script, and finally everybody goes quiet, and he's kind of looking around the table at everybody. And he looks down at the script, and he sits back, and he takes another good 5 to 10 seconds, and he says, "We don't really need to read this, do we?" And everyone just went like dead bone silent. And he said, "Why don't we just start with anybody got a problem?" And I was like, "Well, I do." And part of me, just for for fun and says, I want to read it. But I didn't have the courage. I didn't have the courage to do that. So there was a transition moment where in the second act, if I had said the two lines that I had an issue with, I would have just sold the farm. Like I would have really just confessed everything, and it was just too obvious. And he looked at it and he took a long minute. And then very pragmatically, I was sitting next to him. He just leaned over with his pencil and scratched them out of my script. And that was that. And then maybe three other people said something, but it was all really specific to our characters. It didn't change by any stretch of the imagination the structure of the piece and the story that we were telling. And then we just talked. And it was a conversation. It wasn't him talking at or to us. It was a conversation about thoughts and ideas. And then he had such a firm idea of what he wanted to do with the camera. We didn't really do camera rehearsals either.
Was that daunting that you, given how complicated the piece this was?
I'd worked really hard on learning it. And so I didn't want it to all be gone in 32 minutes. you know, so I was like, and Jason Clark was really lovely. He said, you've got to tell him you need another one. I said, oh, I don't know. He seems so happy. He said, well, you need to be happy too. And I was like, oh, he did work really hard on this. And so I went to him kind of half bowed and said, you know, Mr. Freakin, I'd really like it if I could just have one more run at it. He said, okay. And halfway through the sequence, which again is like 20, 24 minutes long, 25 minutes long, halfway through the scene, Jason Clark's got quite a long speech. And I'm listening and I'm hearing what Jason's got to say. And then this thought just drifts into my head. And all I thought was, I can hear this slowly hitting the floor in an editing room in Burbank. So I'm in the scene. I swear to you, I'm in the scene. But halfway through, I'm realizing he's not going to use a second of this. He's made a point. I'm using that first take because to him, it's organic. And it's real. And the fear that you have from doing that first take is the fear he wants that character to be in that moment doing the testifying.
Okay.
And there's a real reason for it. And he's going to take all of the skill that you've learned over 35 years and all the little gloss points and the little things that you can tardy up. Yeah, he's going to throw those out the window for you.
My guest who just apparently had an out-of-body experience during the making of the game.
Oh, I felt so bad because all I could think of, and I this is the one moment that I wish this wasn't radio or a television show, but I have the ability to take my right eye and make it kind of almost disappear, as I just did to you. And because of that thought, I thought it must have taken my eye and just done this, and poor Jason's looking at me going, what? Yeah. But no, he was a trooper.
By the way, nobody's ever wished this was a TV show before. My guest, Kiefer Sutherland, apparently does. This is The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. There's also a musical approach to this character. In some ways, he's basically like a busker.
Yeah.
Playing to a crowd in that scene. And when we first see him, he's taking the measure of everybody, but mm-hmm. also his own measure and trying to figure out how big a performance he's going mm-hmm. to give. But I was really fascinated again by just watching all these different colorations, just because it feels like it's happening in real time for him. Uh-huh. He's living every person he's speaking to in real time. And was part of that motivated by that fear you're talking mm-hmm. about in doing it?
Well, no, because those physicalities, I knew what I wanted to do. I have a particular fondness of kind of trying to relay physically what's happening on the inside of someone that you might not see through any other part of the outside. And so his foot being kind of pinned inward in this kind of uniquely uncomfortable kind of torturous position, and the hands. And this goes all the way back to Stand By Me. There was a scene in the chicken scene in the car where we've been hitting the mailboxes and Ace is driving and he and his friend are racing in the street and a truck is coming and he won't get out of the way. And so someone's going to have to move, either the car on the right or the truck. And I had this idea, and I'll tell you, Rob Reiner was one of the most generous people I've ever worked with in my life, because I was, 17 years old. And he made me feel comfortable enough to go to him with any thoughts or ideas. And he certainly had his share of like, yeah, that's not going to work. But thank you. good try. And so I said, look, I want to take a toothpick and I'm going to look dead calm, but the toothpick is going to start speeding up in my mouth and it's going to go from one end to the other. And as it gets more dangerous and more dangerous, it's going to be the giveaway that my heart's going and this is going to be my barometer. And he said, yeah, try that. That could be really cool. And it ended up staying in the movie. And so the hand thing is the giveaway of, I might look very stoic and honorable and still in this position, but inside, I'm moving like a butterfly.
One of the things we're talking about is, and if we're looking at the Caine Mutiny versus the Caine Mutiny court-martial, is the generational shift in acting, which is there was something very presentational about the way all those people were, including Bogart, who felt the most real, but still he's playing to the balcony in that stuff. And I've always thought there's a part of you that's shaped by music. And we can probably go back, if you ever come back and do the show again, I'd love to have you do that. We can go through performance by performance and I'd love to hear what your playlist was. Mm-hmm. And I want to know what music was going on in your head.
Good for you to know that there was one. Yeah, because there is.
I've always assumed that. I want to know what the playlist was in your head for Queeg, especially during that scene we're talking about.
His playlist would have been kind of the big band stuff of the 40s. And his playlist was the... you know, the national anthem, and his playlist was "This Land Is." You know,
so almost everything's 4/4.
Oh gosh, yeah. The other version of that would be 6/8, which would be the closest thing, which would be kind of white, low-income farmers blues, right? Which would be country music. His music is the kind of music that allows you to become something, right, and be a part of something.
It's aspiration.
Yeah, and then I can't remember if it was Beck or someone, and I wish I hadn't even said his name, but someone, a musician that I really, really liked a lot during the very big kind of craze of line dancing, and said, the last time I saw people dance like that, Hitler came to power. And I was like, whoa, that was heavy. And I just, that never left me. I've never been able to watch line dancing without thinking we're going to ruin. But it really, it took my breath away. And I thought it was a very astute, clever observation that this person's belief that dance was, should have been singularly expressional. And that the second you get people doing kind of long lines of dancing together or marching band, rah, 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 yeah, some trouble's coming. And that Queeg definitely was part of that because he just wanted to belong.
We're out of time. My guest, who has changed the way I think about the electric slide, is Kiefer Sutherland. He's currently featured, starring in the Caine Mutiny Court Martial on Showtime. I hope he comes back to do the show again. It's a pleasure having you here.
It would be an honor, and thank you very much.
Movie star turned TV star, Emmy Award winner Kiefer Sutherland, on a career that includes starring in director William Friedkin's last project, The Caine Mutiny Court Martial, now on Showtime. The previous and the following take place in real time. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. I don't know what to say about my guest, the actor Giovanni Adepo, except for the fact that in so many of the performances he's given, there have been questions about faith and what he's going to commit to. We go from Mother to working with Denzel Washington in The Fences to his incredible work in the adaptation of the book Three Body Problem, the series for Netflix. First of all, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Elvis. I'm a big fan.
And so much of the stuff you've done as an actor, there have been these questions about these characters' faith. And I just wonder what that does for you as an actor, because it actually asks a lot of you, I think.
I think it's been a blessing to be able to play characters that allow me to look inside of myself and my own faith. I think to be an actor is a task that causes you to face tons of rejection, especially when you're first starting out. And I think to be able to, quote unquote, make it in the industry, you have to have faith and a bit of blind faith. You have to be able to understand that everybody's idea of success is going to be different, and you have to hold on to your specific idea of success. And I think being able to play these characters who are being tested in different contexts, it's been fun to be able to use those opportunities to reflect on my own life.
I'm just thinking, though, thinking about the character you do in Babylon, who I think in a lot of ways, and we can say this about a number of things you've done, you play characters who are kind of the heart and soul of the piece, who carry the kind of the spiritual weight of it. And I wonder if there's something you do to prepare, because I think we can certainly say that's the case for Saul, who's tested in every single episode. And by the end of this season, he's still asking himself, he's still unsure about his faith. So I wonder what you do to sort of prep yourself for these roles. Because again, like I was saying about Babylon, he's certainly the soul of the piece. I think we can say the same thing too about the character you play in Fences. And I wonder if you feel that weight of playing those kinds of characters.
I always try to understand the weight that these characters play to the best of my ability. I think as far as the preparation, it depends on the task, or I should say on the role that I'm playing at that time. I've been really fortunate to have had the opportunities to work with incredibly talented artists. And when I say that, I mean the filmmakers, Denzel Washington, obviously, who I'm a big fan of and I adore. But if we're talking about Sydney and Babylon, Damien Chazelle is a filmmaker that I've been a fan of for years. And getting an opportunity to spend a lot of time preparing Sydney, one, learning the trumpet, but also getting to understand the weight that he was carrying being a Black entertainer and kind of being the pioneer of Black entertainers during that time when we were basically forced to remain background players. I think Sydney had that burden of having to figure out what it means to be a superstar and being a superstar of color and being the first one and not having any other example to look at for guidance. So with that, I think if you understand that context, it really puts the pressure on you to play someone who isn't modeled after anyone specific. And I had a lot of freedom to kind of take in place from different artists of our past that I really admire musically. And I got to create someone who, again, was trying to figure out his own way and figure out a way to stand out and to last in an industry that can bleed you dry.
It's interesting, though, because I think about that character, too, and also in seeing Saul. And these are characters who actually get some pleasure in what they do. And as much as they're kind of both lonely people, Sydney, when he's performing, you can see this light come into him. And when Saul is kind of connecting with that world of sort of fact and that thing that he can do, which he doesn't get to do very often in Three Body Problem, we can sort of see this light come on in him, too, can't we?
Yeah, we can. And I think that's the refreshing thing about Saul. And even when I first met Benioff and Dan Weiss and Alexander Wu to talk about the character, I thought one of the most refreshing things about Saul is that he is a brilliant mind. He's no less gifted or intelligent than any of his colleagues, but he's able to relate to the common person. You know what I mean? Everyone isn't going to understand physics. I sure as hell didn't. But the refreshing thing, I'd be lying to you, Elvis, if I told you, yeah, I know exactly the themes that they're talking about. But I think what's really refreshing about Saul, and when you see him in different scenes as the episodes play, is that he's able to have a conversation with somebody who isn't of their academic background and can still hold a conversation and make you feel welcome. And I think that was just a testament to the showrunners' writing and their wanting to have a difference in complexity and characters that are on the show.
And it's really fascinating to see a character of color, and I'm just going to spoil this, who gets to survive in this kind of world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, was that one of the fun things you get to do, too? Because, I mean, it's because there are liberties taken with the book. I kind of go, well, you say to yourself, well, what's going to happen here? We still see the sacrificial Black character being played out. So to not have him be that, I shouldn't say we're not sure, because there's like a big thing that happens in episode 8 that really like drives home how precarious right. that sort of thing is.
I have to say, I was really happy. And this goes back to that first meeting that I had with the showrunners. It was the summer of 2021 or 22, I think. That conversation we had in the office where they really explained to me what Saul's arc was, I have to tell you, I felt an immense amount of relief that I wasn't going to have to go through that typical kind of throwaway as a role, or I should say. It was refreshing to know that all of the responsibility that a hero wants to have or a character has in certain stories, that I was going to get to portray that, not immediately, but if we get to continue the story. So it was refreshing. And I have to say, there's been quite a few roles that I've played where I've gotten to escape that Reaper. You know, I've gotten to escape that dark ending. So I've been lucky. Let's knock on wood for that one, because I would hate to. I enjoy living. Literally and story as well. I love it.
It's the treatment. We're knocking on wood with my guest, Giovanna Defoe. He's a survivor in so many projects, including Three Body Problem on Netflix. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But I know there's stage work in your background. And I always notice when you're doing something, the way your character is like walk into rooms. I'm sure a lot of this comes from camera blocking, but I'm always aware of the way you plant yourself in rooms. And I kind of wonder where that comes from.
That's actually something that my dad kind of instilled in me when I was younger. He being a military man, as I mentioned before, there was a saying that he said, he used to say all the time, is oftentimes your first impression is your last impression. And when you walk into a room, I think it's really important that you cement yourself as somebody who's confident in themselves more than anything and sure of who they are as an individual. So all of my characters, I would like to, if I can, have that sort of impact when they walk into a room. I think once it starts and you walk in and you're planted, I think everything that happens around you sort of adapts to you versus it being the other way around.
I guess what really gets me about this is you played so many characters in different eras. And I find myself aware of the way these guys live physically in these periods. And I wonder what kind of research you do, because there's a big difference between the way you stand in Fences versus Babylon versus, for that matter, Three Body Problem. I'm fascinated by this because clearly you've studied physicality.
I always like to figure out right away what my character is going to look like. I think that's one of the first steps that I take once I've gotten a job. Because I think that everything else is informed after that, at least for my process. Speaking of Fences, I was 27 when I got that role. And I remember during the audition process, I was freaking out, thinking that I was going to get a chance to play Corey because I was 27 and the character was 17. And I knew that Denzel was incredibly picky and very specific about who he was going to cast. And so that was an insecurity that I had even when auditioning with him. And I didn't want to tell him how old I was. And I remember he would just be like, I'm going to find out, Javon. I'm going to find out. Okay. So just tell me. And I looked down during my screen test and I was like, I'm 27. But the thing that kind of was funny about that reality was at that same time, I was filming The Leftovers. And so I was playing a 17-year-old already. So there was really I have a baby face. So without facial hair, I look like a child. So in that world of filming Fences, I wanted to inhabit my former self as a teenager, you know, the lack of confidence, the being naive and being inexperienced in life. So with that, there's a bit of an aloofness, I guess, to how I walk, a bit of carelessness of not watching or looking around the corner because, you know, you're living in a house that you don't pay for. You don't provide your own food. You don't provide your own clothes. So there's a bit of inexperience to his walk and to his stance. And I think it helped me to kind of remain in that childlike mindset until I can't come back from the Marines, of which case I tried to lower my voice register and stand up taller and straighter. And those different types of specific notes about the character are always fun to explore.
I just found myself thinking, especially in watching, and I watched a couple times actually, just because I like watching how Saul kind of waits almost to the moment of like making people impatient to say something. Mm-hmm. I wonder when that came to you, because it's a really interesting thing just because the other people are kind of all show-offs or constantly sort of talking and spouting facts about what's going on or summing up the situation. It actually gets to be really funny when it's you and Benny Wong, Benedict Wong, because you play, who's going to be slower, you or him? But I just thought it's interesting that you really slow it down for Saul.
I think that's another great quality about him, is that when there is a problem that needs to be solved, it's quite interesting when all of the brilliant minds all come together. And because they all have different strengths and weaknesses, their ways of solving problems or attacking problems are always going to be different. And a lot of the time, if you're trying to solve these equations or what have you in a group, it ends up being kind of chaotic because everyone is trying to prove to the other person or the other people in the group that their method is the best method. Saul, a lot of the time, doesn't have the patience to get into that fight. Like, I don't want to get into a yell, like a screaming battle with you guys. I don't want to get into a huge debate about what I think this idea is or how it needs to be solved. And I think the best thing for him and his own sanity is to always take a step back. Take three steps back to take one meaningful step forward. And if that step forward is him actually giving his input on what this issue is, then so be it. But I think for Saul, it's more meaningful to take a step back, let the chaos exhaust itself, and then I can come in, present a concise idea, and see how it plays.
Because you're playing somebody who, I think, in effect, is kind of the ground floor of the show, the foundation of the show, but he's really running away from the idea of heroism. Also, we see lots of people connect with other people in their lives, and we don't see a lot of that with him in the show. I think, again, these are all interesting things because it means, I'm guessing, gives you a lot of freedom to play things, as you were saying before. But also, you've often played characters with some kind of physical dynamism, and Saul doesn't have any of that.
Yeah, I think that was something, as an actor, I struggled with in the beginning of filming this, because naturally, as you're reading all of the scripts and you're seeing how vibrant and how complex all of these other characters are, I was a bit insecure in how I was going to make someone who likes to be in the background stand out. And that was a question that I'm not even sure that I was able to find an answer to. I think, you know, it was just a question that I wrote in my journal, like, what is so special about Saul? Why does he avoid heroism so much? What is his background? And I think one of the biggest things that I was able to come to understand about Saul as I was co-creating him with the showrunners is that he is someone that I think we all can relate to, or we know someone that is incredibly gifted, has all of the tools that have been God-given, also earned. You know, this is someone who got his PhD in theoretical physics. He's equally talented in comparison to his friends and colleagues, but he just lacks that necessary variable that you need to have that kind of ambition to really want to do something with your life. And you ask yourself, where does that come from? Is there a fear of failure? That's definitely something that I circled in my journal about Saul, the fear of what success is. And again, if we go back to the beginning of our conversation where you asked me about if I use any of my opportunities to play these characters to try to more further understand my own faith, I think Saul is someone that did that for me, because even when we're talking about like what my idea of success is in my career, I think a lot of people end up self-sabotaging themselves because they're afraid of that success if they were to actually achieve it.
I think maybe I was so fascinated by talking about Saul and that character because it's like I said, there is this dynamic quality you brought to so many of the characters that you played. And Saul's lack of momentum almost becomes his own kind of dynamism, you know? I mean, that he so almost creates this kind of gravitational force around himself by pushing away from these things. Because in addition to being around brilliant people, he's also around, as you mentioned, a bunch of people who are achievers, who want to be heard, who were probably all the first people to raise their hands in class. It's almost like he, in some way, is that, and I don't want to give away that title, that he's bestowed upon him, but in some ways, like, he's always been that character when we think back about that, because he's always been the person who's waited until the water is kind of clear a little bit or calmed down to offer something. And there's something actually is really kind of spiritual and philosophical in making those choices to wait.
I don't know if you remember an instance in school or in class where you knew the answer to a question, like a really tough question, and you just decided not to raise your hand, what that feels like. I can recall moments of knowing the answer and raising my hand and just not being chosen. And that's aggravating in itself because, you know, you remember when you're like in elementary school and all the kids put their hands up and they're like, me, 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 me. And then you don't get picked. And then they're like, oh, because they really wanted to present that idea to the teacher and to the class. But it's really interesting to consider the reality that Saul just has no interest in being the person that's going to be on the front lines to help. He would just rather sit back and, as you mentioned, to let the water settle. He's definitely different from me. I do not share the idea of success or ambition with Saul at all. And having to let go is probably the best tactic that I could exercise in playing Saul.
Well, if you're asking, I never raised my hand because I never knew the answer. We're out of time with my guest, Giovanna Adepo, starring in many things. We're talking principally about his work in Three Body Problem, but his incredible body of work in such a young career that's still getting started and clearly has a lot of potential ahead. Thank you so much for doing this, Bible. This is a great conversation.
Thank you for having me, Elvis. It's an honor.
A career that has taken him from being directed by Denzel Washington to starring in a project about keeping the world alive. Actor Giovanna Adepo, whose new show is the Netflix adaptation of the sci-fi thriller Three Body Problem. It's The Treatment. It's The Treat. I'm Elvis Mitchell. If the next voice sounds familiar, then you listen to public radio. Scott Simon has been the host of Weekend Edition Saturday since its creation in 1985. And there he has often spoken about his passions. Here's a lilty one he hadn't got to sing out before.
I'm Scott Simon, and this is The Treat.
Another 100 people just got off of the train and came up through the ground, while another 100 people just got off of the bus and are looking around.
I want to talk about a Stephen Sondheim song, Another 100 People. It's from his musical Company that came out in 1970.
It's a city of strangers. Some come to work, some to play. A city of strangers. Some come to stare, some to stay. And every day.
And it tells the story of people in New York running into each other and brushing up against each other and being lonely and coming together and then coming apart. And his song is sung by a young woman named Marta, and she describes the enormous show that a great city can be.
And they meet at parties through the friends of friends who they never know. Will you pick me up or do I meet you there? Shall we let it go?
When the lyrics say that they meet at parties with the friends of friends who they never know, will you pick me up or do I meet you there or shall we let it go? The way people can walk in and out of each other's lives and leave a memory and leave an impression and leave a stirring in each other's lives and go on with their own. And this seems to me to be a great celebration, certainly clear-eyed, because it talks about loneliness, it talks about the way in which we can feel distant, it can talk about the ways in which we sometimes feel it difficult to make a commitment. But at the same time, it's a song about the great show that big cities can be and the kind of platform and stage it provides for us to be able to find ourselves in our own lives. And it's just a wonderful statement about how we can seek out big cities to put music into our lives, to maybe turn our lives around, to give us something new to connect with. And it may not be forever, but it's for a time in our lives when we feel that we want that.
Where are you going?
Barcelona.
Oh.
Don't get up.
Do you have to?
I was asked to interview him on stage, and I dragged our daughters out there, and of course Caroline. And Caroline and I, another song from Company, Barcelona, we used to sing to each other, except it would be, where are you going to Whole Foods? Do you have to? I would like to get some orange juice and some, you know, that sort of thing. So we were put in separate cars coming from the airport to the, you know, to the hotel, because of the producer booking. It said, look, you know, he's a man of a certain age. He doesn't do children. So we get there to the hotel lobby, but of course we arrive at more or less the same time. And I bring the family over to meet him. And almost as if on cue, Elise, now our 20-year-old, begins to sing, "Where you going, Barcelona, do I have to?" And, you know, this man who had no feeling for, you know, I'm not going to say he got down on the ground and played with them, but he, you know, he leaned down and said, "I have never heard it sung so beautifully before." So they have grown up hearing that, to say the least. And, you know, and when the producer called, like after, you know, find out how it went, he said absolutely nothing about me, but said his kids are great. So.
Scott Simon, host of Weekend Edition Saturday, losing his mind about The Treat. Selected songs by Stephen Sondheim. The Treat is music that elevates, film that stimulates, books that captivate, from those who create and take the time to elucidate about those inspirations that we all celebrate. That was exhausting, but it didn't stop Rebecca Mooney, who edits and produces the program, and Kitty Gilchrist, who mixes. Our poetry was achieved with help from Laura Kondarajian and Sue Margulies. The rhyming dictionary and the pencil go down. To better days, everyone, I promise. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.